First, though, to the unusually strong language being used to describe conditions in Iran, that opaque country, where all is clearly not well. This week, the commander of Iran's powerful Revolutionary Guards, the IRGC, wrote a letter to President Hassan Rouhani, published by the Tasnim news agency, for public consumption, which was interesting in itself. The letter criticised the president for paying more attention to fighting his political enemies than to trying to solve the country's economic problems, which are considerable and have promoted widespread protests with spiralling inflation and the plummeting value of the country. And then there's one of the worst droughts in living memory to add to the pressure. That Revolutionary Guards letter is being read by some analysts as the most ominous sign yet of a wider crisis for the Iranian government and the deepening tensions between the country's hardline and more moderate forces. With the deadline for new American sanctions looming, many Iranians believe the country's facing a pivotal moment. For her analysis, I'm happy to welcome Dr. Sanam Vakil. She's adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins University and an associate fellow covering Iran at Chatham House. Sanam Vakil, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Do you think Iran is facing a pivotal moment, or is that overdrawing it?
No, it is indeed a very pivotal moment, really, because there's all of this domestic pressure that you mentioned. And then in tandem with that, there are the forthcoming sanctions and the deep disappointment over the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. So coming together, there is this sort of interconnected crises that are putting significant pressure on the Iranian government.
With what I read from The Guardian and others, it's being recognised inside Iran in a very strong fashion, promoting a great deal of almost despair and a sense that they're drifting badly.
Yes, since January, the Iranian currency, the rial, has lost more than half of its value. We've seen protests that have been ongoing really since December and January of this year, and protests continue to pick up and then slow down throughout cities all across the country, really revealing that ordinary Iranians feel very disenfranchised and frustrated enough to take to the streets and air their deep grievances and sense of frustration with not just America's policy towards Iran, but also with the legitimacy crisis that is really at the heart of these issues, where the Islamic government has failed in providing economic justice and growth and employment to the population. And you hear in the chants of these protests that people are challenging the supreme leader. They're questioning Iran's foreign policy, supporting proxy groups in the region. So this sort of confluence of frustrations are coming together, and we're likely to see more of that.
Yes, one reporter said of the protests, the people aren't chanting for democracy, as President Trump would have had us believe earlier in the year. They're chanting for water and bread.
Yes, they are indeed. They are deeply angry that the nuclear deal failed. And the nuclear deal was something that overwhelming members of the population had supported and voted for, because Rouhani, the Iranian president, was reelected promising to build on the success of the nuclear agreement, for example, and remove even more sanctions. And average Iranians really want economic integration. They don't want to live through another round of sanctions and isolation and the like. And this ultimately affects them, their pocketbooks, their ability to purchase basic goods, their ability to access running water. And it just ultimately points to decades of government mismanagement.
Well, in fact, I'm going to come back to President Trump's role, but the drought is obviously having a profound effect too.
Well, the drought is not a new concern. Iran has been experiencing a drought for a number of decades. Of course, it's waxed and waned at different times. But even when I was going back as a child, there are very important rivers that have dried up. And that's been, you know, a huge shock to the society and to the local communities. But the drought is affecting farmers, is impacting local populations all around the country. And the importance of the nuclear deal here is that Iran was partnering with international organizations and agencies to deal with this very monumentous environmental crisis.
Where is it being felt most and how?
We've seen protests in southern Iran, all throughout the country. I mean, Iran is in a huge economic and environmental paralysis.
But they've got sort of water shortages too, haven't they? And recurring cuts to electricity.
And
that's a terrible.
Yes.
We know a lot about drought in Australia. It certainly doesn't make people feel ready to have confidence in the future.
Definitely, because these are basic resources that have been mismanaged over the years and potentially so destabilizing. So lack of running water, power shortages, poor air quality. And a lot of these issues are actually not just in large cities, but all around the country. The nuclear agreement actually was going to open the door to greater international cooperation and collaboration to address some of these issues. But again, and I keep coming back to it, it comes to systemic government mismanagement of these basic issues that are bread and butter issues for average Iranians.
Now, President Rouhani sacked the head of Iran's central bank earlier this week in a gesture designed to bring down some of those economic pressures under control. And it does seem to have been welcomed by the international community. The new man who's come in seems to be regarded as more likely to manage a crisis. So they've still got some levers to pull, clearly.
They do indeed. Of course, sort of recycling your cabinet and replacing ministers and, in this case, central bank governors, it's sort of a classic pass the buck sort of scenario. And it does restore confidence, even if it's only for a short time. But there's not so much that the central governor is going to be able to do, because as of next week, the first round of sanctions are going to come down, and this is going to constrain Iran's banking, already limited banking relationship with the international community.
Yes, that's from it's targeting trading in cars, gold, and other metals. And then in November, America will introduce sanctions designed to curb Iran's oil exports, which is really the country's economic lifeline. So, look, I'd really like to know what your judgment is about whether this sort of behaviour, action by the US, is going to, in a way, drive nationalism up to the fore and drive some of these groups together. And that's always been the argument about Iran. Never test their nationalism, it'll always win. Or whether it is going to be a bit of a tipping point moment. What's your assessment?
Well, obviously, it's hard to predict. So I'm not going to fall completely one way or the other, but I can say somewhere in the middle, there are portions of the population, of course, that could rally around the regime. And there's immense pressure on the political establishment, hardliners and pragmatists around President Rouhani to also unite. And they're trying to build momentum and use the card of nationalism to encourage Iranians to fight a bit longer, to stand sentry a bit longer. It's hard to convince them amidst all of these challenges, though. But the card of nationalism has been and will continue to be really an important lever for the Iranian government to try and mobilize the population in its favor. But there is also the other portion of the Iranian citizenry that is sort of fed up, frustrated, and just wants anything, any help, any sort of different system. And that's why this situation is somewhat dangerous.
Yes.
Really, because we're in this leaderless moment, if you will. The Islamic establishment is going to stick together and protect itself, although there is competition between hardliners and reformists and pragmatists also taking. Then you have a growing movement among the people, but that's leaderless, and leaderless,
yes,
moments and leaderless protests can be equally dangerous because you never know who or what can emerge.
Well, in fact, the lifting of sanctions in 2015 that occurred seemed to be helping Rouhani on the path to wresting some economic control back from the Revolutionary Guards. I mean, this is another subset of this very, very interesting multifaceted story, because I think the argument is that they control sometimes up to 60% of the Iranian GDP, and Rouhani is trying to wrest back control. So I wonder whether this, again, you do wonder about the timing of the new sanctions.
It is unfortunate because if you do subscribe to the fact that Rouhani was indeed trying to reform and push back the influence of the Revolutionary Guards, Trump's withdrawal from the nuclear deal is in fact going to have the opposite effect, because new sanctions is going to empower the guards. And they have always benefited from smuggling and having a wider influence during this period. So unfortunately, this is where we are.
Are you seeing, in your view, any systematic organization of those opposed to the government?
So there's a difference between outside the country and inside the country. And I'll take the outside first. Outside, there is a group known as the Mujahideen-e Khalq that has been anti the Iranian government for decades now. But they are almost a cult. Some people would call them a cult. And they've been supported by members of government in the United States and Europe. But they are actually the worst alternative. There are monarchists that still are around and seek to sort of revive the monarchy around the Shah's son. There is no viable opposition inside the country. The government has been very successful arresting and marginalizing and eliminating organized groups. So there is a vibrant civil society, and people have an idea of what they want. They don't know how to get there. And I'm not sure that there are leaders in this moment in the country, because they've just been living under four decades of an authoritarian system. So this is why we're in sort of this dangerous crossroads as well.
Well, I am going to ask you to chance your arm. What do you think in the next 3 months, what are you expecting that we'll see?
Well, I wouldn't discount a number of variables. First of all, we should see continued protests. The question is the government going to continue to allow these protests more or less without a full-scale crackdown? Because they realize that they just need to be more accountable and provide a bit more space for people to express their frustration. And can they manage these protests? So I suspect that that's this sort of angle that they're going to try to use, manage the protests and allow people to express their frustration. I think they're also going to remain committed to the nuclear deal over the next 3 months as well. Iran is in a unique position this time compared to last time. When there were sanctions imposed. There's not complete unity between the United States and Europe in imposing these sanctions. And Iran has to take advantage of transatlantic disunity in order to continue to press upon European countries, the JCPOA, and help give Iran some sort of economic benefit.
So do you think
they're going to stay in the deal?
Do you think we'll see regime change?
No, not right now. It's very easy to prognosticate about regime change. It's very hard to change the regime. And I think that the world has not forgotten the last regime that was changed in 2003. The Iraq War.
The Iraq War.
Yes, and this is a very different regime. This is a very different country, very nationalistic. And frankly, I'm not sure who we're going to regime change for. There's no real candidate, and that turns me above everything.
Sanam Vakil, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Sanam Vakil, with that wonderful distinction between talking about regime change and changing the regime, adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins University, associate fellow covering Iran at Chatham House, talking to me there from the US, and apologies for the quality of our Skype connection there, by the way.